Parsha Va'era begins with the famous Arba Lashonos of Geula, the four expressions of Geula as are good, noted, as are outlined in the Pasuk here, Perek Vav, Pasuk Vav, Lachen Emor Lebnei Yisrael Ani Hashem. These are the predictions for Bnei Yisrael. I will take you out from the burdens of Mitzrayim. I'll save you from their labor. I'll redeem you. And then, I'll take you to me as a nation. Now, needless to say, and it's important to point out, as we always do, that what we refer to as the four Lashonos of Geula, which is actually not an expression, I don't believe, that exists in the Chazal, but rather the concept of Arba Geulos. These are four aspects of extraction, or four aspects of deliverance from Mitzrayim, which is then capped with the Vehevesian Pasuk Ches. And altogether a different dimension, I would say, to these Arba Geulos is provided in the Shem Yishmuel, Shmuel of Sokotchov. As we know, Golas Mitzrayim does not just historically take its place as the first of our exile experiences, which is then followed by Bavel and Paras and Yovan and Rome. It's not just there as the first, but actually is considered to be the root Golos experience, as if to say, you could almost call it the Maase Avos for us of Golos, of which the four Golios themselves are then considered to be branches. It's for this reason the Medrash tells us that when Avram is foretold about the Golos in the Bris Ben Abisarim, and the Pasuk states, darkness descended, there was a great dread and darkness that fell on him. And the Medrash associates each of these terms, Eima, Chasheicha, Gedola, Nofeles, with one of the Arba Golios, as if to say that they're all compacted and they're all included within this root experience that Avram was formerly being told about. And indeed, as the Chidah points out, Al Derech HaRemez, as we know, the Torah transmits on many wavelengths. In the very beginning, as the Pasuk describes the Jewish people coming to Mitzrayim, in Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph, Ve'ele Shemos B'nei Yisrael, Haba'im Mitzrayima. So Haba'im, which is notable because it is in the present tense. And Ba'im, says the Chidah, has the letters Beis, Aleph, Yud, and Mem, which is Rashi Tevos, Bavel, Edom, Yovan, and Modai. That means that as the Jewish people are coming practically into Mitzrayim, they are conceptually entering into what will ultimately emanate as these four Golios. And as such, if the Golos Mitzrayim is the root of all of those four Golios, then the Geula from Mitzrayim is then the root of all of the Geulos from those four Golios. And it's interesting if we consider that each of the Golios, in a sense, has a different characteristic. By that we mean, the characteristic of Bavel, first and foremost, is that it was a Golos which took us from Eretz Yisrael out. We were exiled from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel. In contrast, what we call Golos Paras, which is actually what Golos Bavel morphed into, because ownership of the world, so to speak, was taken over from Babylon to Persia. And what is that we faced there? We were not moved anywhere. We stayed more or less where we were, which was everywhere. But rather what we faced was a mortal threat. It was a threat to our actual existence through Haman, Lashmid, Larog, Ula Abed, And that's a different type of galus. No one moved us anywhere, but our very existence was being threatened. If we contrast yet that with the third of the galios, which is Yavin, which is Greece, as we've just been through Hanukkah, it was none of the above, as if to say we were not moved from our location in Eretz Yisrael, and we were not off location, we were on location. Having said that, we were our authority and our autonomy was very much challenged. We were taken over by Yavon, even at home, and that's a concept of Golus that can yet exist, depending on who you ask. And as such, the final Golus, in a sense, differs, because the first three, of course, if they're followed by the final one, that means that they themselves were not final. The redemption from these first three did not constitute a full and ultimate redemption of the Jewish people and fulfillment of their mission and destiny in the world. With this background, says Shemi Shmuel, if we take a look at the what we call the Arba Geulos, the Arba Lashonos of Geula, and we focus on the verb, on the term that's used, we will see that beyond the immediate setting of Mitzrayim, each one actually refers to a geula from one of the subsequent Arba Galios. And let's take them one by one. The first, as we have seen, is Vehotzesi. I will take you out, as if to say, I will remove you from there. That is a reference to the first of the Galios, because the first of the Galios took us from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, and therefore Vehetzesi means I will take you out of there back to Eretz Yisrael. The second Galus, which was Paras, where, as we said, Lashmid, Larog, Labed, our existence was threatened, the Geula from there takes the form of removing the threat. And that is the expression of Vehitzalti, I will save you. People are saved from those that are trying to destroy them. That's what the second Golas was about. And therefore the redemption is referred to with the term Vehitzalti. What about the third term, Vegoalti? Geula, as we know, is not so much a question of location or under threat, but rather an issue of jurisdiction. Redemption is a question of status. We find, for example, the term geula is applied even to property in Parshas Bahar and Parshas and with Yovel, geula te'ele aretz. When ownership changes, that's called geula. And therefore, because the critical issue with regards to Golas Yavon was one of ownership, we were not in charge of ourselves, others were in charge of us, the redemption, or the extraction, from that Golos is referred to as Geula. It's an issue of jurisdiction that we then were able, as Rambam says, V'chazra Malchus li Yisrael, Yosimu Masayim Shana, and therefore Geula is appropriate to Golos Yavon. What then about V'lokachte Eschem li La'am? Because, as we've noted, the first three Geulos were not final, there was a Geula after them, and therefore we were not fully achieving our status and destiny as Am Hashem. It is only the final Golus, the Geula therefrom, redemption therefrom, that will lead to what the Pasuk describes as V'lokachti Eschem li La'am, V'yisi Lechem Lelokim, to be fully connected in that way, and once again reinstated for good in Eretz Yisrael, V'yisi Eschem El Ha'aretz. So this is really a fascinating insight and vista into an itemized understanding of how the Arba Lashonos of Geula ultimately refer and play out in the Arba Geulos from the Arba Golios later on. I believe there is perhaps room to add one more thing. The four Golios, one of the places where they were foretold was in Daniel's vision, where he has that famous dream and he has those different beasts and there's four of them and each one corresponds to one of the Golios. The Medrash tells us that Daniel did not envisage or did not dream about or receive all of these in a dream at the same time. Rather, they were broken down in that the first three were experienced in the dream on the first night, and then the fourth one was on the second night. So that's very interesting that they're broken down in that way, divided up in that way. everyone knows the easiest way, if you insist on dividing four, will be to divide it into two sets of two. But they were not divided into two sets of two. They were divided into two sets, one of which contained three, and the other contained one. And the message, says the Medrash, is that in its own way, and of course easy for us to appreciate in hindsight, the fourth galus is equal to all of the first three. As if to say, not only in terms of duration, not only in terms of difficulty, also in terms of the elements that were present in the first three, as the Maharal discusses at length, all come back in the fourth galus. And therefore, on the one hand, it's number four in a list of four, but on the other hand, it's its own entity equal to the other three. It's interesting to note in this vein, another correspondence, and the more you look in the Medrash, the more you see that the concept of the Arba Galios runs through the Torah almost. And very commonly we meet sets of four, and there's some type of relationship between them and the Arba Galios. And another classic set of four which corresponds, according to the Medrash Vayikra Rabbah, are the four beasts that have only one kosher siman. If it's only one kosher siman, it's not kosher at all. No such thing as a half kosher lunch, as they say. But they are mentioned specifically, and the Medrash explains how they are: the gamal, with the camel, the shafan, the arneves, however those are defined, the hyrax, or the hare, or whatever they are, and then the pig at the end. And the Medrash explains that each of them corresponds to one of the galios and discusses briefly the point of correspondence. What's very interesting is we are treated to a presentation of these four beasts, which have one kosher siman, twice in the Torah. Because on the one hand, they feature when the halachas of kashrus are first discussed, which is in Parshas Shmini. But then, as we know, Mishneh Torah and Sefer Devarim goes over them, adding in its own way in Parshas Re'eh. And these four beasts actually, therefore, are also mentioned twice. It's fascinating, therefore, as Rabbeinu Bachya points out, to see a point of contrast between the two presentations. Shmini on the one hand, Devarim, that is to say Parshas Re'eh, on the other. And what is the difference? If you look in Parshas Shmini, you will see that each of these beasts features in its own pasuk. Eszeh lo tochlu es hagamal, because it's malagera, but not mafris parsa. That's one pasuk. And then the shafan, same again, second pasuk. Third for the arneves, and fourth for the chazir. However, if you look in Parshas Re'eh, you will see that when the Torah reiterates these four beasts, it puts the first three in one pasuk and the fourth one in its own pasuk. It just goes through them very quickly. Sagamal, Vesashafan, Vesarneves, that's one. And then the chazir is in a second pasuk. One could say, in the interest of brevity, after all, it is true that the first three have the same kosher siman in common. I mean, they all chew the cud in whatever way they do, but do not have split hooves, as opposed to the chazir, which is the opposite. But Rabbeinu Bachya says that these are two ways of understanding the relationship of the fourth galus to the first three. And we're treated to both of them because we have two presentations, which means on the one hand, historically or experientially, each one is a separate thing. And therefore, in Parsha Shmini, each one gets its own pasuk. But on the other hand, ultimately, the fourth is equal to all the first we put together, and that is communicated and indicated by the second presentation in Chumash Devarim, whereby the first three are in one pasuk, and number four gets a pasuk all for its own. I was mindful of this because in light of the comment of the Shemesh Shmuel, it's most fascinating to note that we have exactly the same thing in our parsha, whereby Pasuk Vav, the first of these psukim, Perek Vav, Pasuk Vav, states, Votzeitzi Eschem, Yitzalti Eschem, Vegaalti Eschem. The first three stages of Geula are all in the first Pasuk. And then Velakachti Eschem Li La'am is in the second Pasuk. And that fits in, I believe, very nicely with the way that we have seen that pattern with other references of the Arba Galios. Once we understand that these four expressions ultimately pertain to the future four Galios, and we see the number four is equal to the first three, and it features some in a pasuk all of its own, we find similarly in the Arba Lashonos of Geula in the beginning of Parshas Va'era. So that is certainly, as you say, a dimension that is worth reflecting on from the beginning of Va'era. Now, I'd like to take a look briefly at the beginning of Perek Zion. There's quite a bit of build-up and there's quite a bit of setup until we actually get to the Ten Makos. And the beginning of Perek Zion, basically HaKadosh Baruch Hu is more or less informing Moshe how things will go. And for that matter, that they will not necessarily go so smoothly. For he states, already in Pasuk Gimel, Vani Akshe Eslei Paro, I'll harden his heart. Don't think he's going to say yes straight away. Moshe has already been told that he will not. But he will not listen. And then the Makos will come. Let us pay specific attention to Pasuk Dalad and Pasuk He. Because as much as there is a systematic build-up in terms of the forecast of what is to come, we wish to make sure that things aren't just stamp being repeated. But they seem to be. Between Pasuk Dalet and Pasuk He. And in order to understand what that means, let us see these Pesukim. Pasuk Dalet reads, V'lo yishma lechem par. Par will not listen. V'no asati es yodi b'mitzrayim, will then lay my hand against Mitzrayim. V'otesiyas sevosayas sami b'nei Yisrael, me eretz Mitzrayim b'shvatim gedona. And I will take the b'nei Yisrael out of Mitzrayim, with great judgments. So that is more or less what is in store. He won't listen, there'll be signs and wonders, and I will take the B'nai Yisrael out. Pasuk, hey. V'yod'u Mitzrayim ki ani Hashem, Mitzrayim will know that I am Hashem, bin tosiyas yodi al Mitzrayim, as I stretch out my hand against Mitzrayim. V'hotzeisiyas B'nai Yisrael mitocham, and I will take B'nai Yisrael out from their midst. So of course, we see, if we only begin to look, that the Jewish people are described as being taken out of Mitzrayim twice in two successive sukkah, but you can't take them out once they've already been taken out. What type of Yetzias Mitzrayim is there once in Pasuk Hey when they've already left? In Pasuk Dalet? That's a good shaila. And again, these are psukkim that it's easy perhaps to gloss over because makas haven't begun yet. But these are the preparatory psukkim. So based on the comment of Meshech Chochma, I believe that the answer to what seems to be a dual reference or redundant reference will come from seeing exactly or specifically how Yetzias Mitzrayim is described in these two psukim. If we look again in Pasuk Dalet at the end, it says, "Vahutzeisias tzivosai esami b'nei Yisrael me eretz Mitzrayim b'shvatim gedolim. I will take them out from the land of Egypt." Pasuk He concludes with the words, "Vahutzeisi es b'nei Yisrael mitocham. I will take b'nei Yisrael out from their midst." And therefore the question really is, what is the difference between Hashem taking B'nai Yisrael out from Eretz Mitzrayim and taking B'nai Yisrael out from their midst? If they're not in Mitzrayim, they're not in their midst. Again, it seems to be the same thing. But we can already see that there is a different character to these two references to taking B'nai Yisrael out. And here, Meshech Chochma says, he comments more on Pasuk Hey, but we can set that against Pasuk Dalet. For the truth of the matter is that the full meaning of Yetzias Mitzrayim, as we know, is not just geographical. In the sense that B'nai Yisrael have been living in Mitzrayim, under the influence of Mitzrayim, surrounded by Mitzrayim, and Mitzrayim at that time, and it's no coincidence, Mitzrayim at that time was really the center of where things were happening. They were considered to be the most successful nation, the most powerful nation. And here are the Jewish people. And from a certain point of view, they're somewhat enamored by them, as the Jewish people sometimes can be. As if to say, they're exposed to what seems to be the cutting edge of the world order, and they're quite taken by it. And as long as that's true, and as long as they retain such high regard for their host, in spite of all the oppression, and the Jewish people are capable of taking oppression and still, in a sense, looking up to the host nation because they consider them, at the end of the day, to be succeeding. That being the case, Yetzias Mitzrayim will not be complete just by removing them geographically from Mitzrayim. Because as long as they continue to have that regard for Mitzrayim, then Mitzrayim still has a hold on them. And they haven't left. Not fully. Not in every sense of the word. And therefore, as much as Pasuk Dalet describes the physical exodus, and that's why it is termed with regards to location, Votesies Tzivosai Esami Bnei Yisrael Me Eretz Mitzrayim, it's about taking them out from the land. They're in the land, they leave the land. That's the more external aspect of Yetzias Mitzrayim. But Pasuk Hei describes something else. And it's fascinating to see through Meshech Chochma how the two parts of the Pasuk go together, because we might not necessarily have put them together. Again, the Pasuk from beginning reads, V'yod'u Mitzrayim ki ani Hashem. Mitzrayim will know that I'm Hashem. Bin Tosias Yodiyah Mitzrayim, when I stretch out my hand against Mitzrayim. And then, V'otesis Bnei Yisrael Mitocham, which we discussed. Says Meshech Chochma, this type of Yetzias Mitzrayim is different than the first. And in fact, not only is it different than the first, not only is it more conceptual and not just geographical, but it is actually a product of what is mentioned at the beginning of the Pasuk. These are not two separate things. Mitzrayim will know that I'm Hashem and I'll take Bnei Yisrael out. But rather, says Meshech Chochma, the Pasuk, there's a continuum here. There's an A leads to B. Through Mitzrayim, knowing and recognizing that I'm Hashem, says Hashem, that is how I will take Bnei Yisrael out of their midst. How so? Because when Mitzrayim, which is the very nation that the Jewish people look up to, perhaps at the expense of their own heritage, and perhaps at the expense of their own background, and they see Mitzrayim as the way forward, when Mitzrayim itself is brought to a point that it recognizes that the Jewish people are right, at that point the Jewish people can leave Mitzrayim. Because when these people that are so successful in their terms realize that the ultimate success lies with the Jewish people, then that can allow for a full break of the hold that their value system has and their way of life has. When they themselves are forced to admit that the God of the Jewish people, he is right and they're in the wrong, the Jewish people will find it then all the more easier to part ways with them and everything they represented. And all the things that they admired, they now see as broken or shallow or whatever it is, and thus leave Mitzrayim completely. And that's called Vahutseisiyas B'nai Yisrael Mitocham, from their midst, from being surrounded by them, from being affected by them, and from being enamored by them, of them. And this then is the wonderful comment of Meshech Chochma, because already at the beginning of Parshas Va'era, before the Makos have begun, we get the full spread of what Yetzias Mitzrayim will entail and the role of the Makos in terms of the recognition that it will lead Mitzrayim to, which will then beget a chain reaction, and the Jewish people themselves will come to a recognition about themselves, about the Egyptians, what they thought was so impressive, and what ultimately is of worth and of value. That's called Yetzia Mitocham. Well worth pondering and reflecting on, those words of Meshech Chochma. Now, I'd like to discuss for a few moments, perhaps more than a few, one of the central features, which we've already actually mentioned in passing, but to look at it a little bit more in depth, and that is the concept of the hardening of Paro's heart, which is such a central thing. Of course, Yetzias Mitzrayim just wouldn't be the same without the hardening of Paro's heart. If his heart wasn't hardened and he said yes straight away, I don't know if we'd be disappointed, but certainly Yetzias Mitzrayim would not have looked the same. But he did not say yes. He said no. And the process that leads him to say no is called Hashem hardening his heart. Now, as we may know, this very concept is actually quite disturbing and troubling, in the sense that it leads to a very basic question with regards to the way that Hashem dealt with Paro. Because if we would describe sequentially what happens, Hashem demands that he say yes, but then doesn't allow him to say yes, and then punishes him for not saying yes. Now, very hesitantly, I think we can apply the well-known modern Hebrew phrase that sums up this type of situation, and that is, ze lo fair. Because he doesn't have the chance, the option of making the right choice, and he gets punished for making the wrong choice. But it just doesn't sound just, in a sense. And this is the well-known question. Rambam raises the question, as do many others. Rambam's answer, which is quite a stern answer, is that the truth is that he had... Part of his punishment was that he was not having the opportunity to say yes, the ability to say yes more correctly. In other words, all of this is his punishment. The cause and effect is not that he's not punished for saying no. His punishment is that he has to say no and then be punished for that. But he had stacked up credit, quote unquote, that led to that punishment over decades. And therefore, it's all over before the whole thing begins. It's a famous discussion of the Rambam in Hilchos Yesodei Torah, Hilchos Teshuva. And there are other Rishonim and other Mefarshim who give other explanations. The first five, the second five, Mida Keneged Mida, he hardened his heart, Hashem hardened his heart. Many, many discussions. Each one really deserves its own forum, without a doubt. However, I would like to present a very different approach to the whole concept that we call the hardening of Paro's heart. And it comes from the classic Perush on the Torah, Maaseh Hashem, of Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, one of the early Acharonim. And his Sefer is all full of wonderful things. And the Maaseh Hashem is basic thesis, and as we'll see, he discusses it at length, but if we look further, we can see that it preceded him. But let's begin with the Maaseh Hashem. See, we are of the notion, says Maaseh Hashem, that the concept of hardening Paro's heart is almost like a supernatural mechanism or transaction, whereby Hashem, so to speak, reaches down his throat into his heart and switches it from on to off. And now it's stone. There's nothing you can do. But that is not the way that the Maaseh Hashem understands. The Maaseh Hashem understands the hardening of Paro's heart in what we could term a more, quote-unquote, natural way. I mean, how is it natural for a person's heart to be hardened? What it means is, says Maaseh Hashem, and perhaps we'll just preface, very often we talk about a person who has no choice, which is very interesting. Because how can you have no choice? And who is responsible for that? Sometimes people are manipulated. Sometimes people are put in a situation where, given their makeup, given their personality, given their psychological tendencies, they may see themselves as having no choice. Someone from the outside sees they have perfect choice, but they don't. This can happen in a normal setting. It's very interesting to take the concept of what we call hardening someone's heart and bringing it out of Paro into perhaps even more common experience. You can very often leave a person with no choice. If he's in a public setting and someone begins to insult him loudly and publicly from the forum, from the podium, how long will it be before he leaves? He will be left with no choice but to leave. He can stay there. He can stay there and receive abuse if he wants, but most people won't. And not only won't they, but they'll find it impossible to stay there. They can do what they want. The laws of biology allow them to. It's easier, actually, just to stay still than to get up and leave. But we all know that it's impossible. And so it is with many people that given their reactions to certain things, you can almost sometimes predict the way that they will act without fail. And how can you do that? They can always choose. But you know what they'll choose, because you know them. And sometimes a person can be forced to have their heart hardened and left with no choice to relent. Such a person is Paro. And again, we say it can be understood in a much more natural way than perhaps we might normally understand. You see, if we consider, says Maaseh Hashem, and he takes us through it, look at Paro, and he receives Moshe, and Moshe threatens him, and Moshe says, "I come in the name of an omnipotent force," and he demands that you let his people go, or else. And Paro says no. And what would Paro do, if he were that omnipotent force? I mean, he do what he does whenever he can, and that is if there are people who are rebelling or disobeying or confronting him, he'll wipe them out. The good old-fashioned way. And yet, somehow, that doesn't happen. Much to Paro's surprise. See, what's so interesting about Paro is that he is expecting Hashem to act the way he would act. He would show no mercy. He would come in decisively, destroy it, and take. But this force by Moshe doesn't do that. And Paro, he superimposes the way he would act over the way Hashem is acting and concludes that Hashem can't do it. There's only one reason why one wouldn't destroy, and that is because he can't. But that already plants a seed within Paro that whatever force Moshe claims to be representing is not as strong as he claims that it is. And therefore Paro just feels if he can stick it out, in the end he will prevail. And the truth is, there's more to it than that. From a certain point of view, Paro is lured into this mindset. We find, for example, and again, for us it might be almost disappointing. We find, for example, that the first two makos, and the first impressions last, the first two makos, in one way or another, the Egyptian magicians and wise men are able to replicate it. That's hardly an impressive show of force. And it's true that perhaps they can't do to the same degree or whatever it is, but it doesn't seem to be as decisive as we would have expected. From Makkah number one, the water turns to blood, and the Egyptians tried to do it, and they couldn't do it. No, they tried to do it, and they succeeded. I mean, I didn't make themselves very popular with anyone by just creating more blood. But it's a matter of principle. Principles and popularity don't always go hand in hand. And the same thing with the frogs. Moshe produced frogs, and they produced frogs. And what's happening here? Says the Maaseh Hashem, this is the hardening of Paro's heart. Because when Paro allows his opinion to solidify, so to speak, with these first two makos, that whatever Moshe can do, my people can do, from that point on, for him to change his mind would require him admitting that his initial assessment was incorrect. But if you're Paro, that's impossible. But it's only impossible because he's Paro, as if to say because of his ego and he's the emperor and he'll show them, etc. That doesn't mean he has no choice. A person can admit that he made a mistake at any time. So it's not a supernatural thing. It is an all too natural process. Get Paro to admit he made a mistake. He'll see his kingdom crumble before he'll do that. That's the hardening of Paro's heart. And even, I would say, earlier, when we see the first confrontation, before the Makkos, there's almost like a pre-round, where Paro says, show me a sign. And Aaron takes a staff, and he throws it down, and it becomes a snake or a crocodile, depending on how you translate it. And that's the sign. That's his calling card, representing Hashem. What happens? Paro calls his magicians, they do the same thing. And in fact, according to the Medrash, because the Pasuk says, Vayikra, Gam Paro, Lachacham v'lamachashvin. The word Gam translates as always, but the Medrash is very sensitive to the word Gam. Gam is a ribui. It comes to include others. Who are the others? Who apart from the wise men? Says the Medrash. He called in his wife, and she had her own Rebbetzin staff, and she threw it down, and it became a crocodile. And then he called in his children from magic school. And they had their little staffs, and they threw them down. It was like a Gansa circus. And Paro felt that he had the last laugh, which of course he didn't, because the follow-up is the Aaron staff or the others, but Paro doesn't stick around. That's small print as far as he's concerned. Those are details. Paro can't be bothered with the details. He's stuck in the victory, and there's no turning back. And all of this is the concept of hardening Paro's heart. And in fact, even his initial resistance seemed to pay off, as we know from the end of Parshas Shemos. Round one went to Paro, in the sense that Moshe comes and demands, Komar Shem Elokei Ivrim, Shalach Hazemi Ve'Avduni. Let them go, let them serve me. And Paro says, no. And not only does he say no, but he makes the work harder for them, seemingly with no consequences. As we know, that's the end of Parsha Shemos. And Moshe comes back and complains. And he pays for complaining, but he can't help it. He feels the pain of the Jewish people, and he doesn't understand, as much as we can say about Moshe. But you see in the pasuk, he comes back, Lama Hariyosa Lama Zeh, why have you made things worse for this people? Lama Zeh Shlachtani, why did you send me? Umeoz Bosia Paro Ladaber Bishmecha, from the time I came to Paro, meaning this first meeting, Hey Rala Lama Zeh, he's made things worse. Vahatzelo Itzalta Samecha, he didn't save them. And Vahatzelo Itzalta, which is an absolute infinitive grammatically, means you didn't even save them a little bit. Meaning at all. The Hatzalah didn't even start. It just seems to have gone backwards. And Moshe is upset. And voices this to Hashem. And what is Hashem's response? And this is like the final pasuk of Parsha Shemos. And you just have to wait a week to find out what happens next. But the final pasuk, which was mistakenly placed as the beginning of chapter 6, Perek Vav Pasuk Aleph, as we know, the allocations of the chapters are not Jewish in origin, and therefore they miss the point a little bit, that this is really Moshe's, this is Hashem's response to Moshe. It's not a new thing. Vayomar Hashem al Moshe, Hashem says to Moshe, Perek Vav Pasuk Aleph, what can we do? That's how we refer to it. Atatir Er, now you will see Asher Esel Apar, that which I will do to Par. Ki v'yad chazakai shachem, v'yad chazakai gashem me'atzo. Through my strong hand, he will send them out. And we must ask, if we try and be yekish about the exchange here, how has Hashem's words responded to Moshe's complaint? Moshe's complaint is, things have gone backwards. Hashem's response is, now you'll see. But that only explains now. Moshe isn't asking about now. He's asking about just before. So you haven't explained that. So how is Atatira, with an ayin, Atatira, how is that an answer to Moshe's, why did the first meeting go badly? The answer must be that what Hashem is saying to Moshe is that the first meeting, because the first meeting went badly, now you'll see. As if to say, it was important that the first meeting go badly for us, for the Jewish people, because then as Paro has convinced himself that he is stronger than you, Moshe, and me, says Hashem. Once he's convinced himself of that, he will not turn back, and there will be a concept called Yad Chazakah, and it's not going to be over until Egypt is in ruins. That is the product of the first meeting going badly. It was a process of hardening his heart. And the truth is, as Mefarshim point out, and it becomes a discussion in each of the Makos, each of the 10 has something about it that did not check out. It did not happen exactly the way that Moshe said it would. But there's something about it where Paro is able to latch on desperately, cling to that and say, you see, as much as the Makkah came, but it wasn't exactly the way he said, whatever it would be, sometimes to the detriment of Paro, to the extent, as we know, that even Makkah's Bechoros, which is number 10, 10 out of 10, his chachamim, there were the stopwatches or were the sand clocks or whatever, waiting for chatzos. Is it going to be early? Is it going to be late? That type of demented obstinacy is a product of the hardening of Paro and his inner circle. They're hardened. So this then is the approach of of the Ma'asei Hashem. And it's so different, as we can appreciate, from what we could call the general approach or the standard approach, because according to this, there is no room to ask, how can you punish Paro if you didn't give him a choice? Paro had as much choice as anyone who has an ego has choice to admit they made a mistake. If he doesn't do it, he doesn't do it. But no one can ever say, I should be absolved of the consequences of my actions because I have a flawed character. And therefore, the question almost fades in that way. He's accountable for his actions. So this is the concept of the hardening of Paro's heart. And as I said, it's possible to identify it. So far, I have seen two earlier sources than the Ma'asei Hashem, who would seem amply to be a precedent for understanding the hardening of someone's heart in this way. The somewhat earlier than the Ma'asei Hashem, there is a sefer called Sefer Ha'ikarim. It's one of the classic philosophy svarim of Judaism, Rabbi Yosef Albo. And Rabbi Yosef Albo, in his way, he actually draws our attention to what you could say is a lesser known example or case of someone's heart being hardened by Hashem. If we would ask, how many people in the Torah does it say that Hashem hardened their heart? The answer is one, Paro. But that's not so. There were actually two. Paro's famous, and Sichon, Sichon Melech Emori, is less famous for this. But the Pasuk says it, where? In the end of Parshas Devarim, it says that when you came to Sichon and you offered peace, and but he didn't take it. He didn't take your offer of peace, if that sounds familiar. But rather, he went to war. He took his nation out, and they went to war with you. Why? The Pasuk says, Ki chizek Hashem es rucho, Hashem hardened his spirit, ve'imetz es levavo, and strengthened his heart in order to deliver him to you. So here again, not exactly the expression of hardening his heart, but it's almost the same concept. Chizek es rucho, hardened his spirit, strengthened his heart, emboldened his heart. And what does that mean? It's once again, it sounds to us like Hashem just switched him from on to off. And he has no choice but to leave. And by the way, leaving was a disastrous move for him, because in his city was heavily fortified. And Rashi tells us from Chazal, it would be very, very difficult for the Jewish people to conquer that city. And he left it. What possessed him to do that? Says the Sefer Ikrim, and we'll see how this is the forerunner for the Maaseh Hashem. When it says Hashem hardened his heart, hardened his spirit, what it means is he gave him to misinterpret events. How so? Sichon was not the first kingdom that we approached asking for passage through. The first was Edom. All of this is discussed in Parshas Chukas, Sefer Bamidbar. First we went to Edom, straight after the Memariva. We sent a message to Edom, we'd like to go through, famous words, Ebronah v'artzecha, b'derech ha-melech neleich, we won't trouble anyone, we just want to go through, we'll pay for anything that we take, v'chule v'chule. And what happened? Edom said no. And Edom threatened to go to war with Bnei Yisrael. And what was Bnei Yisrael's response to that? Vayet Yisrael me'alav. Bnei Yisrael did not get involved. If the response was no, with a threat of war, the Jewish people moved somewhere else and tried another point of entry. Says the Sefer Ikrim, watching that episode very carefully was Sichon, and he drew his conclusions. And what were those conclusions? Sichon was stronger than Edom. Sichon is meant to be the protector of that whole region. He's stronger than Edom. But he sees that when confronted or with the specter of a military confrontation with Edom, the Jewish people back away. That means that they are not as strong as Edom. But Sichon is stronger than Edom. Do the math. And the result is Sichon, it's clear to him, based on those events, that he can conquer the Jewish people. And therefore he rushed headlong out of his city to his defeat. And what possessed him to leave? His interpretation of events. But the Pasuk says, but Hashem strengthened his spirit. Hashem emboldened his heart, as if to say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu set that whole thing in motion. And then it's up to him to see if he thinks he's going to destroy the Jewish people. But all of this was, again, it is a natural manipulation, in the sense of Sichon, the way he fancies his military prowess, etc., vis-a-vis others, his interpretation of people's reactions to what it may be in the region. And that is that really resonates with what the Maaseh Hashem says. That's called Hashem hardening his heart. It's just a question of giving him to misread a situation. And he as good as had no choice, as is the case with people in that situation. And the truth of the matter is, it goes further back, that is to say, even than the Sefer Ikrim, to the Rebbe of the Ikrim. The Ikrim is written by Rabbi Yosef Albo, who was a student of the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim. And the Ran has a famous collection of drushas, drushas Haran, those 14 drushas. And the way the Ran describes it, one could almost say it is mefurish in the Pasuk, unless you find another way to explain it. And that is in Parshas Beshalach, when we leave Mitzrayim. What happens? So we're leaving, as far as we're concerned, we're not going back. And then HaKadosh Baruch Hu says as follows. We know this is the beginning of Perek Yudalit of Shemos. Hashem says, tell Bnei Yisrael to backtrack. Tell them to look like they're lost. That's important for what's to come. Because when Pyro hears, and he will hear, that they're wandering around and blundering a little bit, and they don't know where they're going, he will say, Nevuchim heim ba'aretz. They're lost. That's what the word Nevuchim means. Whoever translated Merah Nevuchim as Guide to the Perplexed was looking to sell the Sefer Guide to the Perplexed. Because no one likes to admit to being completely confused and lost. But that's what Nevuchim means. important to be faithful to that original. In any event, so Pyro will say Nevuchim heim ba'aretz. So he will see that they're lost. Then what does it say? Then the next pasuk says V'chizakti yislev Pyro, I'll harden his heart, and he'll run after them. So the run asks a simple shaila. You know, if you're hardening his heart, we could save a lot of travel. Because if you're going to harden his heart anyway to get him to chase after them, so why do the Jewish people need to go anywhere? Why does he need to be led to believe that they're lost? Harden his heart and he'll leave. But we see that these two things happened. Because these two things go together. Or perhaps more accurate, these two things are the same thing. As if to say, giving power to understand or to misunderstand that the Jewish people are lost, with that his heart is hardened. These aren't two separate things. Neither is redundant. One is the form that the other one takes. And therefore we see almost, I think, mefurish from the psukim, that the way that Hashem hardened Pharaoh's heart, the means, is described in that earlier pasuk. Go back so that he'll think you're lost. That is how his heart is hardened, because he will not interpret it any other way when he realizes he's being set up. And this, therefore, is the Ran, which again, forerunner for the Ikrim, and put the two together, forerunner for the Maaseh Hashem. So these are very interesting discussions, as I said, that relates to such a central concept within B'Yetzias Mitzrayim. For a final item for this evening, I'd like to talk a little bit about the fourth Makkah, Makkas Arov. We know what form it takes. It's all these wild animals. That is discussed in the Torah in Perek Ches. Perek Ches. Beginning with Pasuk Tet Zayin. And as we will see, there are one or two chidushim, actually. One or two aspects of the Makkos, which are introduced with Makkas Arov. We find, for example, Pasuk Tet Zayin, Vayom Hashem Moshe, Hashkem Baboker, get up early, V'syatzev Lifnei Pharaoh, Hidnei Yotzei HaMayma. Get up early, go to Pharaoh, he'll be by the water, and tell him, Shalach Esami, Shalach Ami V'yavduni. Moshe has never been told to get up early to go and speak to Pharaoh. This is the first time. What's behind this timing? As we know, we break the Makkos down into these groups on Seder night, into really three groups of three. Makkos Bechoros is attached to the third group of three, Tetzachadash Ba'achav, and not only are they three groups of three in the sense of, you know, each three represented something different, as the Mefarshim explained, but they have their own internal circuitry, one could say, within each group. You find thus, as the Mefarshim, Malbim, certainly at length, described the first of each three as Moshe confronting Pyro by the Nile, the second as Moshe confronting Pyro in his palace, warning him, the third, there is no warning. And that's the cycle as it goes. The Makkah just comes without warning. Lice, Kinyan, number three, there's no warning. And what is the meaning behind confronting Pyro by the Nile and in his palace? The Nile is the deity of the Egyptians, which is a source of power. Pharaoh's palace is his own temporal, represents power, to invade his own home and confront him in that way. There is one thing, though, and this the Medrash says. Pharaoh, as much as the Nile was a deity, Pharaoh rated himself and presented himself as a deity. The thing is, though, being a deity, that means that he did not have need for recourse to any bodily functions normally, which means he used to perform those things in the Nile. before the day began, no one would see. And that's why it was especially uncomfortable for him to be confronted there by Moshe, which was number one, which actually took place at the Nile, because Paro's there for other reasons, and Moshe's confronting them, and it just makes it all the more uncomfortable. So much so, says the Medrash, that Paro was afraid that would happen again, and therefore he decided to get up earlier so that he can deal with all of that before Moshe might appear. And that's why this number four, which is the second time Moshe was confronted by the Nile, it says, Hashkem lifnei Paro, wake up earlier. Paro's doing hashkama, so be sure to he can't get away with it, so to speak. It's also interesting that in Pasuk Yud Zayin, there doesn't seem to be as if to say in this fourth Makkah, it's the first where the Makkah takes place without either Moshe or Aaron doing anything. Certainly, according to Rashi, the first we were done by Aaron. He hits the Nile, he hits the ground, he whatever it might be. For the frogs and for the blood, there is no act here. It just happens. It just comes. That's also something of a chiddush. A pasuk which captures the attention of many mefarshim is pasuk Yud Zayin, for reasons that we will see. The pasuk Yud Zayin, the peret ches, reads as follows: Ki emeincha mishalech esami, if you do not send them, hineni mashliach b'cha, I will unleash towards you, your servants, your people, your houses, esha'arof, all sorts of different wild animals, v'gam ha'adama asherhem aleha, and also the ground upon which they are. And that final phrase, as we can appreciate syntactically, it's difficult to know what it's coming to clarify or even what it relates to. V'gam ha'adama asherhem aleha. What is the meaning of those words? And there's many perushim. There is actually a classic perush. It is ascribed, attributed to the Vilna Gaon, and also to the Rebbe Reb Heschel in the famous Sefer Chanukah Satorah, that there is actually a creature who's referred to in the Mishnah in Kilayim, who draws his sustenance from the ground. If you would detach it from the ground, this creature would die. It's called the Yidoni. Because the Pasuk says that all the wild creatures came, including this one, but it can't be detached from the ground, and therefore for this one it says v'gam ha'adama asheim aleha, and also the ground that it's upon is also transported so that it can be part of Makas Orav. That's a famous interpretation. But the Alderach HaPshat, the Ibn Ezra explains, v'gam ha'adama asheim aleha means, so far it says that the wild animals will come to the houses. And what if people don't live in houses? They're not safe. They are referred to with the final clause, v'gam ha'adama asheim aleha. Even people who just live on the ground, I mean, they just live on land, and they don't live in a house even, they will also be affected and afflicted by this. The Sforno and the Malbim explain somewhat differently. The words v'gam ha'adama asheim aleha, heim, them, who are they? Pronoun. What is it referring to? The most recently mentioned object are the houses of Mitzrayim. If we look back a few words, Mashliach b'cha v'avadecha v'amecha uvivatecha, and your houses as ha'arav umalu bati Mitzrayim. They will fill the houses of Mitzrayim with arav. V'gam ha'adama asheim aleha, and also the land upon which they are, says this foreigner, means upon which the houses are. Heim is the batim. Meaning that people might think, you know, if they enter the house and they close the door, they'll be okay. But the point is that the ground upon which the houses will also be filled. They'll burrow under, they'll tunnel under. Locking the door is not going to help, because they'll find the way inside the house, because they'll be in the ground upon which the houses are. V'gam ha'adama asheim aleha. Very interesting is the final. Again, on Derech HaPshat, in his way, the Ksava Kabbalah, Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, who of course is famous for his way of understanding the different possibilities of what a word might mean. Here, he interprets the word v'gam, does not mean always. Pardon me, does not mean also, which gam means also, which is the Pashtus, but v'gam is a verb, because the word gamam means to make a hole, as we talk about a guma. Guma is a hole, a cavity. Vigam is the verb of that concept, which means to tear something up and to create holes and disruption. And therefore, what it's saying is they'll ravage the land. V'gam ha'adam asher asheim aleha means all the land that they pass over, they'll tear it up. That's how the Ksava Kabbalah explains. Very interesting and characteristic, one could say, of the Ksava Kabbalah. Another chiddush here is that Paro begins to give to a degree. Until now, nothing to talk about. And yet, after this one, if we have a look in Pasuk Kaf Aleph, Vayikra Paro el Moshe ula Aaron vayoma, and he says, Lechu zivchu lelokechem ba'aretz. He's prepared to concede something. Until now, nothing. They've said to him, we want to be going to the desert, and that's where we're going to have our Chag Lashem. And he says, Lechu zivchu lelokechem ba'aretz. He allows them, but it's got to be internal, on location. And the question is, what is behind this middle ground, one could say? It's not exactly what Moshe is demanding, but it's not nothing. I mean, where does it come from? So Bepashtus, it seems that he's just, he's going to give something, but he's not going to give everything. You know, Kedarkam Shel negotiators, and therefore he gives them something. Okay, you can have your festival, but here, not there. That's his either saving face or whatever. Maybe he's worried that they will never come back, which in the end, they didn't. Now that's not on the cards, to have this Chag in Mitzrayim, but that's what Paro suggests. Again, a concession. But the Meshech Chochma says something more, a fascinating idea. And that is, Paro doesn't know, let us assume, Paro doesn't know that the reason why Moshe says Hashem demands they be sent out in order to serve him in the Midbar is because Hashem just wants the Jewish people out. As far as Paro is concerned, he takes things at face value, and that's part of the Midah Keneged Midah, that he was duped into letting them go. He thought they'd be back, they're not back. But he thinks, so why in the Midbar? Because Paro knows enough about these things to understand that if the God of the Jewish people is not prepared for them to have a Jewish festival in Egypt, because Egypt is not, the atmosphere and the level of contamination there spiritually is not conducive, it's not appropriate to have a godly event there. And Paro recognizes that. Maybe he's proud of it. And therefore, he understands that the Jewish people do not consider Mitzrayim to be an appropriate location for a festival for their God. So, what's changed? What's changed is, and this is a fascinating idea, Makas Orov gets Paro thinking that perhaps there's something about Egypt that does make it an appropriate location. The fourth plague, and he says this after the fourth plague. Why? Because Pasuk Yutes says Vesamti Pedus. This is the first time we find in Torah Shebichtav. This is the first time we find explicit in the Pasuk that Hashem says, I will distinguish between my people and your people. Vesamti Pedus Beinami Uveinamecha. Vehiflesi, he says. And really what that means is the Pasuk is openly describing and foretelling that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will distinguish between the Jewish, his people, and others, and protect his people, and leave others prey for the Makkah of Arav. And that's what happened. Pasuk, that's what happened. And because that's what happened, so Paro now says to Moshe, it could be that the land of Egypt is appropriate for your festival. Because what do you want? Where are you going? Why are you going into the Midbar? Because the Midbar is a neutral setting, and that's where God can appear. He's appeared here. He's protected you in this plague. He's made his presence manifestly clear in the way that he has distinguished between you and everyone else. So the Shekhinah, he wouldn't use that term, but the divine presence is here. It's here in Egypt protecting you. So if he's here, so you can have your festival here. That's where it comes from. Now, of course, Moshe is not prepared to, he's not about to agree because the Jewish people need to leave. But that's a very interesting understanding of why Paro feels that maybe Moshe would agree. In terms of what you need for a festival, you've got it here. What do you need? An encounter with the divine presence? You just had one through the last plague. All the Jewish people were protected miraculously from these wild animals. What's most interesting is, and perhaps with this we'll conclude, Paro was right, as if to say, in principle he was right. In practice, he didn't realize the Jewish people, there's no way they were going to stay in Mitzrayim. They need to leave anyway. But this notion that the divine presence ultimately is what determines where Avoda is, in that respect, he was correct. And the truth is that happens in next week's Parsha. In the next week's Parsha, we know the Jewish people, their first Korban was offered in Mitzrayim. They didn't wait till they left Mitzrayim before they brought the Korban Pesach. They brought the Korban Pesach in the heart of Mitzrayim. How could they do that? Is it not inappropriate? It's appropriate because the divine presence was there, protecting them from Makas Bechoros. And so much so, as Meshachot actually says in next week's Parsha, the blood, as we know, of the Korban Pesach was applied to the doorpost and the lintel. And without going into details, but it's clear that there's an opinion in the Gemara. We know that a Korban, you apply the blood to a Mizbeach. There was no Mizbeach here, but they did put it on the doorpost. And the Gemara says in Psachim, Daf Tzadik Vav, the doorpost was the Mizbeach. Except most doorposts are not Mizbeach. How is the doorpost in Mitzrayim a Mizbeach? So the Meshech Chochma, you know the doorpost came to be a Mizbeach? Because what is a Mizbeach? And what's so special about it? It's the place where the divine presence rests. It's the place where Hashem's presence is clear. It was never clearer than in Egypt when he passed over all the Jewish homes, and therefore their doorpost became a focal point for the divine presence. That's a Mizbeach there. You can put blood of a Korban there. So it's fascinating how the concept, again, before things certainly became finalized and formalized in Torah mitzvahs, how the concept of a Mizbeach became applied to the place in that setting, in that unique pre-Matan Torah setting. They basically, you had the equivalent of a Mizbeach. Much food for thought. We'll leave it over there for this evening.